You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, now we have AUT's Alan Blackman joining us for Dear Science today. How are you going, Alan?
I'm doing very well, thanks, Shemina.
Awesome. So first up, we're talking about George Ola. Is that how I say it?
It is indeed how you say it, yes.
Great chemist who passed away this week. Can you tell me a bit more about him?
Okay, so when some famous movie star or politician or whatever passes away, it's normally sort of front page media news. You see it everywhere. Sadly, Nobel laureates in chemistry, when they pop their clogs, as it were, then you don't sort of hear much of it, unfortunately. So
kind of relegated to the specific science or tech sort of sections.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, if that even. Yeah. So sadly, last week this guy George Ola died. Now, he won the Nobel Prize in 1994 for chemistry. And the citation read, for his contribution to carbocations. I'm guessing that probably not many of your listeners know what carbocations are.
Probably not. I think that's a safe assumption to make.
Okay, so interesting life story. He's born Hungarian way back in 1927. And he did all his training in Hungary, all his undergraduate and postgraduate PhD, etc., etc. And then there was the Hungarian uprising in 1956, where the Soviets came in and tried to sort of suppress any sort of freedom in that country at that stage. And following that, a whole lot of people got the heck out of Hungary, including George Ola and his wife and kid at that stage. And they moved to Canada. And it was in Canada and then later in the United States that he did all the work that he became famous for. And in a nutshell, what he became famous for was things called super acids. And so, again, your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with the concept of acids. Mm. They know what acids are, they know what bases are, so kind of the opposite. But we think of acids, particularly sort of strong acids like your hydrochloric acids and your sulfuric acids and stuff like that. We think of them, maybe you pour them on a table and they eat through the table because they're such strong acids, etc., etc. Certainly they dissolve metals and things like that. You've all seen that in sort of at school and test tubes. You get a bit of magnesium and put it into hydrochloric acid, bubble, bubble, bubble. His contribution to this was creating acids that were actually trillions times stronger than sulfuric acid. And sulfuric acid is a really, really strong acid. You get that on your skin, it burns instantaneously. It really hurts like hell, leaves, very, very nasty stuff. So that's the stuff that they used to throw in people's faces and parts of the world.
Right, okay.
Acid attacks and stuff like that. So he made super acids, which, as I said, were trillions of times stronger. You might think is just sort of some academic curiosity, but in fact they're very, very important in the petrochemical industry. So in petrol refining, you end up with different fractions of petrol, gasoline, whatever you want to call it, which have got different octane ratings. And so the higher the octane rating, the more cleanly it burns, the more powerful it is, etc., etc. So obviously it's important that you get petrol with as high an octane rating as it all possible. And what Ola did was he found that these super acids gave him a way of increasing the octane rating of petrol. And so basically you just had to treat these hydrocarbons, this low-grade gasoline or petrol, with these super acids, and out the other end would come higher octane gas. So
major possibilities.
Oh, yes, indeed. This is, you're talking megabucks here with anything to do with petrol. So what perhaps might have started off as a bit of an academic curiosity ended up a very, very important industrial process. The carbocation thing that I mentioned that he got the Nobel Prize for was sort of a byproduct of this. If you've done any chemistry, you'll know that carbon always forms four bonds. And so Ola found that he could get carbons that had three bonds or carbons that had five bonds and that they were stable. Normally you can make these things, but they disappear pretty instantaneously. And Ola, with his super acids, was able to basically store these things in a bottle. And for that reason, the super acids also got the name magic acid. And a nice little sort of New Zealand connection to this, Ola, working on these things, he made stronger and stronger and stronger acids. the world's strongest acid that has been made was actually made by a New Zealander who was a professor of chemistry over at UCLA.
Really?
So, yeah, really. Yep. And actually trained at Auckland University, got his PhD at Auckland. I'm pretty sure the PhD, certainly his undergrad anyway. But so there you go. A Kiwi's made the world's strongest acid. That's the world record holder since 2004.
World record holder in acid strength.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's kind of cool.
So. And so next we're looking at another death of another Kiwi scientist, Bill Pickering, except he died on this day 13 years ago.
He
so
did.
Can you tell me more about him?
Well, it's the Ides of March. So a few famous people died on the Ides of March. Julius Caesar being the most famous.
Yep. That's the classic. Classic one.
And William Pickering also died on the Ides of March, which is why we're talking about him today briefly. But a very, very famous and possibly underappreciated New Zealand scientist. He trained at Canterbury University briefly. He studied engineering down there. And then he went to Caltech, which was in sort of the 1930s, which was a very, very unusual thing for a Kiwi lad to do. You know, Caltech, one of the world's finest scientific institutions. So he was obviously a very, very impressive student. Went to Caltech, did a PhD in physics there, and then he ended up being a professor of electrical engineering at Caltech. And then in 1944, during the war, he went to a place called the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which was run by Caltech. And here they were looking at basically at missiles and rockets and stuff like that. So that then became his lifelong work, looking at the development of guided missiles and rockets. And in around about 1956, he took over the directorship of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And this was the year before Sputnik went up. So that was the first artificial satellite, which was launched by the Russians in 1957. So he got into the Jet Propulsion Laboratory just at the right time to be a part of all of the amazing things that happened in sort of the 50s, 60s and 70s in terms of anything to do with space. And so after Sputnik went up, there was enormous pressure on the Americans to respond in kind with their own artificial satellite. And there were numerous failures. A little search of YouTube will show you all these sort of rockets blowing up on the launch pad and stuff like that. And Pickering and his crew at Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL, in 1958 came up with Explorer 1. So they constructed this and they were instrumental in its delivery by rocket. And that became the first American satellite to orbit the Earth. And then following that, in the succeeding sort of 20 years till his retirement in 1976, he was heavily involved with the National Aeronautic and Space Administration, all of the rocket launches that were happening at that very exciting stage. And he was instrumental, certainly, in unmanned missions to both the Moon and Mars. And I think it was Pioneer 9 was the spacecraft in 1971, was the first spacecraft to orbit Mars and take photos of Mars. And this was all under his direction. So a kid that was born in Wellington went on to lead sort of one of the highest scientific institutions in the USA. So he certainly has been honoured by his home country. He got the Order of New Zealand before he passed away, and he got an honorary knighthood. Had to be honorary because he took out US citizenship, so he didn't. He wasn't a Kiwi anymore after that. So apparently, yes, I know. any of you living out in Albany Way, you'll know William Pickering Drive. And I had a look at that on the map just before, and appropriately running off that are streets like Armstrong Street, Lovell Street, and there's another astronaut one which evades my memory at the moment. But So
in a sort of thematic area of Albany.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
I also read that his name is bestowed on a peak in the Kepler Mountains of New Zealand's Fiordland National Park.
Yes, indeed it is. Yeah, so he's somewhat immortalised, but, you know, hell, let's put him on a banknote or something. So.
A road isn't enough, or a mountain. We need banknotes. So finally on today's segment, we're talking about some news from Australia this week. Some pretty controversial stuff. Do you want to tell me a bit about that?
Yes, this will probably get phone calls. But in New South Wales and Queensland and Victoria, you cannot send your kid to childcare if they haven't been immunised. And so Malcolm Turnbull is now looking at making that nationwide law. So essentially, yep, you have to immunise your child if you want to send them to childcare. And, you know, I'm all for that. I think that's a very, very important thing to do. There is, of course, resistance to this from people who are influenced mainly by a guy by the name of former doctor Andrew Wakefield, who in 1998 published a paper in the premier British medical journal, The Lancet, saying that there was a link between the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine and autism. Mm. And the study was horribly flawed, and in 2010 it was withdrawn by The Lancet, so basically taken out of the scientific record. And Wakefield was also struck off as a doctor in the USA. He was, however, I believe, still free to practice. In the UK. Sorry, he's free to practice still in the USA, unfortunately. And he has made a movie last year called Vaxxed, which was to be shown at the Tribeca Film Festival, run by Robert De Niro. And Robert De Niro has an autistic child. And so that was to be shown, but then it was pulled at the last minute. And this is going to be shown apparently in Auckland, somewhere in Auckland, we don't know where, on April the 2nd. They're only going to divulge the place where it's going to be shown 3 hours before it's going to be shown, apparently, to stop all these rabid vaccinating people sort of going away and protesting at this. So, yeah, obviously this is a very, very emotive issue.
Yeah.
Obviously it is. Nobody wants their child to be afflicted with autism. It's a terrible, terrible thing. But the thing is, there is no scientific evidence out there that there is any kind of link between the MMR vaccine and autism. There's absolutely none. The only one was this Wakefield study, and he's been shown to be a complete charlatan. And so really, it's important that everybody gets vaccinated. Mm. Remember a thing called smallpox?
Yeah.
That used to be the scourge of humanity, absolute scourge of humanity. We eradicated that because everybody got vaccinated against it. And now it doesn't exist anymore. It's gone. Polio, again, you know, it used to be a horrible problem in New Zealand. You know, people, you get polio, you have to live on those iron lungs. It was just an awful, awful thing. I was watching a documentary on a wonderful BBC program called Unreported World a while back, where in Pakistan people are going around basically ordering parents not to vaccinate their children because it's some sort of Western ruse or something like that, and polio is endemic in Pakistan because of this, and people are living in fear of these people coming around and doing terrible things to them if they go and vaccinate their kids, you know. And it's just horrible, all the misinformation and everything out there. It's just shocking. And sadly, compulsion seems to be the only way to get around this, and that's what the Australians seem to be doing. So really, you know, compelling parents over there to vaccinate their kids. Apparently 5% of kids in Australia are not vaccinated, according to a recent poll, and about 7% of New Zealand kids haven't got their vaccinations up to date by the age of 8 months. So there's still work to be done there.
Absolutely.
One of the main problems, isn't it, where you've got a selection of the population who aren't vaccinated, is that you ruin a thing called herd immunity?
Yes.
Is that
yes.
what it's termed?
Yes. Like, yeah. yeah, absolutely.
Would you kind of explain that a little bit?
Well, basically, if you have unvaccinated people, then you can still have diseases that are passed between them. And so if for some reason your kids can't be vaccinated, say they have an allergic reaction or whatever to the vaccine, then they run the risk of being infected through basically no fault of their own. So, you know, if we want to eradicate things like measles and mumps and rubella, which we obviously do because they can be deadly diseases. You know, people can die of measles. Hell, when I was a kid, we didn't have MMR. And so, you know, I've had measles, I've had mumps, and that was just sort of a rite of childhood. But people, you know, did die from these things.
Yeah, absolutely, that there are real sort of possible negative impacts of this. I remember hearing about, I think it was perhaps in parts of California where there was a rise in certain diseases because of the number of people who weren't vaccinating their kids.
Yes, they had an outbreak of measles at Disneyland, I think, a couple of years ago. Yeah, yeah, and there was about 100 and something cases of measles because of that. And I think, yeah, a couple of years ago, somebody died in California from measles, or Washington State, actually, from measles. So, you know, these things are dangerous. And if we can eradicate them, which we can, if everybody vaccinated their kids, then why not do it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so I saw also that Andrew Little was calling for the government to look at adopting a similar policy in New Zealand.
Yes.
Do you think that this is likely?
I would imagine that the majority of the population wouldn't have any problems with it. So if you've got the majority on your side, then you know what politicians do.
Right, yeah. I think the health minister has said that there are no plans for this, but there was definitely no sort of outright rejection of
sure,
it. So yeah, because obviously it's a very sort of sensitive issue.
Yes, indeed. And obviously we'll see what happens in Australia if this goes through. And then obviously if it does, then I think the chances of it happening here would be quite high.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us again this week, Alan.
Not a problem. Always my pleasure, Shamina.
See you again next week.
Thank you.
That was Dear Science.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.